of microphone adjustments. Our next speaker is Sir Colin Humphreys, who is the Goldsmiths Professor of Materials Science and Director of Research in the Department of Materials Science and Metallurgy in Cambridge University. He is the director of a couple of other research centres in Cambridge, all of which represent his research interests in gallium nitride materials and devices, advanced electron microscopy, and high-temperature aerospace materials. He's a professor of experimental physics at the Royal Institution in London, fellow of the Royal Society, fellow of Selwyn College, fellow of lots of other things, trustee, and involved in so many, giving so much scientifically and socially. Interestingly, in his one of the websites I looked at and one of his lists of professional interests, he's a trustee of Link House Trust, which is a Christian-based housing for international students in Cambridge. So a man of very wide interests and commitments, and is actually mentoring a student from my church. So I know this is the one successful mentorship that has been set up. If you're a student here, do ask. You can be put in touch with similarly senior people, or maybe less senior people in your university, to chat with you and find out how you're getting on, give you some advice about science and faith as well. So that's a little plug for that program in the midst of my introduction. But we're going to hear from Colin about his quite extensive work that he's done on miracles, a number of books he's published, which are no doubt on the bookstall. So thank you, Colin.
Fine, well, thank you very much, Ruth, for that very kind introduction. I shall look at the screen here while I talk. So, I guess no talk on science and Christianity is complete without a quotation from the Archbishop of Atheism, Richard Dawkins. And this is what he said about miracles in an article he wrote in 1999. The resurrection, even the Old Testament miracles, are all freely used for religious propaganda, and they are very effective with an audience of unsophisticated and children. So if you believe in miracles, you know what you are. Every one of these miracles amounts to a violation of the normal running of the natural world. And that's one of the interpretations of miracles which Mike Paul has just given in his very nice talk. Lots of people consult Wikipedia. So this is what Wikipedia says about miracles. A miracle is an event not explicable by natural or scientific law. So again, agreeing with Richard Dawkins, or Richard Dawkins agreeing with Wikipedia. And then, like Paul quoted Hume, and Hume says, a miracle is a transgression of a law of nature. And I think if you asked most members of the public what a miracle is, this is what they would say: a miracle transgresses a law of nature. And some theologians would certainly believe that as well. On the other hand, Augustine, great Christian scholar, Bishop of Hippo, he wrote a long time ago, miracles are not contrary to nature, but only contrary to what we know about nature. And I think if Augustine was speaking today, he might say, miracles are not contrary to science, but only to what we know about science. So he's basically, it's totally the opposite view to Richard Dawkins and Hume. He's saying that they don't break any scientific rules because God's a consistent God. And if they appear to break scientific rules, it's because our science isn't good enough. And when we know more about science, we'll find that miracles don't break any scientific laws. And a number of theologians believe this. And it so happened I was speaking to Rowan Williams just a few weeks ago as a guest at his college at dinner. And before dinner, he was chatting to people. And he came over to where I was. And I said to him, have you written anything recently? And he said, I wrote something about Augustine. And I said, do you know what Augustine says about miracles? He said, yes, I know well what Augustine says about miracles. And I said, you know, he said they're not contrary to nature. Yes, I believe that. I said, do you think the resurrection fits in with what Augustine said? And he said, yes, I do. So a lot of theologians will believe this position. It's a very logical position to hold. So what I want to do in this talk is to look at two biblical miracles, if you like, very important miracles, the crossing of the River Jordan and the resurrection. And the crossing of Jordan was, of course, the climax of the Exodus story. There's a sort of theological link between the two, which we shouldn't push too far, but Joshua led the Israelites across the Jordan. The Greek for Joshua is Jesus. And so when people, when Joseph was asked, you know, to call his son Jesus, in his mind, other people's mind, they're linked back to Joshua. And of course, the New Testament refers back to the Exodus a lot. So Joshua led his people out of slavery into the promised land of Canaan. And Jesus, through his resurrection, led people into the promised land of heaven. So that sort of theological link. So these two miracles, the Bible regards both of them as great miracles. And I think we need to ask ourselves just now, do we regard these as miracles? If these events happened as described in the Bible, were they miracles? And I think Richard Dawkins would say yes. He could, of course, go on to say they didn't happen. But I think he would say if they happened as described in the Bible, they are miracles. And Augustine would certainly say this, and the Bible says this. And I imagine most people would say this. Let's say these are two miracles we're going to look at. And we're going to try to take both a biblical approach and a scientific approach. So crossing the River Jordan, the climax of the Exodus story, can science throw light on this? And let's ask this question, does it amount to a violation of the normal running of the natural world? So this is a story in these two verses of Joshua, very plain language, but a lot of information. The Jordan is in flood, all during harvest. Yet as soon as the priests who carried the ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam in the vicinity of Zarethan, while the water flowing down to the Sea of the Araba, which we now call the Dead Sea, was completely cut off. So the people crossed over opposite Jericho. If you just try and picture this scene in your mind, the River Jordan is not flowing normally. It's in flood. It's a raging torrent. The Israelites one side. They wanted to be on the other side. They could see in the distance their promised land of Canaan. And they waited about 40 years to get to where they were. But the situation just looked hopeless. But suddenly, this river stops flowing. It's as if someone has got a giant tap and turned off this tap and the river stops flowing. And the Israelites then cross the river in triumph. Let's say you were to go out in the streets of Oxford and proclaim this story. Yes, this is a reaction we'll get. Just a wonderful children's story. What a great story. What a great fairy tale. But let's ask, can it be true? Can we know what happened? The best date if this happened is probably about 1200 BC. So we're talking about something which is over 3,000 years ago. Can we know what happened at this distance? And as we said, most people would say it's a legend. And in fact, probably many biblical scholars. But many biblical scholars do say this story is a legend. So when I read this story for a few years ago, I found there was a very curious detail there. We have to ask the question, what did the writer intend? Did he mean it to be a factual story? Or did he mean it to be historical fiction? That's fiction dressed up in historical language. And also, what did his original audience understand? And there's a very strange detail in this story. I wonder if you realize this as we were reading it. So if this was made up, if this was historical fiction, I think what the story almost certainly would say is that as soon as the priest's feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing, it piled up by the feet of the priests. The story says it piled up in a heap a great distance away. In other words, this miracle didn't happen where the Israelites were, it happened somewhere else, right? A great distance away. So that's a remarkable feature of the story. And the writer is at pains to tell us where it happened. He says at Adam. And in case you don't know where Adam is, he says in the vicinity of Zarethan. So he's at pains to point out this miracle happened somewhere else, and he tells us where it was. I suspect that if you accept this, the Israelites crossed, and Joshua said to them, he had a party, said, look, go and see what happened. Let's go upstream and see what happened. So they actually found out what happened. So the people then crossed over. I think it has the ring of truth about it, this story, if you like. It's something you just wouldn't make this up. So this of course, raises the question, if the water stopped flowing in this place called Adam, what stopped it flowing? And just in passing, we should note the really careful attention to geography, which is throughout the Exodus story. So this particular part of the story, the writer tells us where they crossed. It was opposite Jericho. He tells us where the water stopped, at Adam, in the vicinity of Zarethan. He said all these places are upstream from the Dead Sea. So he's trying to root this story in geography as well as in history. And I think he intended this story to be a factual story. So, of course, that raises the question, where was or is Adam? And if you look on a map, you will find no place called Adam. And this is not surprising because places which existed 3,000 years, by and large, either don't exist today or they've changed their names. There are a few exceptions to this. Jericho was called Jericho 3,000 years ago, and it's called Jericho today. Let's try and find out more about Adam if we can, because there are ways of exploring if places have changed their names. I mean, a place in India called Bombay is now called Mumbai, and you'll realize there's certain linguistic similarities between Bombay and Mumbai. Ancient Hebrew, so the Hebrew of the Old Testament, was just consonants. It was a consonantal language. When you read it, of course, you had to put vowels in, or if you read it in your mind, you put vowels in. And the situation is similar to text messages. So those of you who do text messages will know you often miss the vowels out. And so for text, you write TXT, and in your mind, you read that as text and not tixt or toxt or taxt, because the context says it should be text. And in the original Hebrew, the word Adam was written as the two consonants in Hebrew, which were D and M. So the Hebrew for D and M, and there's a sort of breathing sound in front, which you can see. If ancient Hebrew words then become more modern Arabic words, there are sort of traditions by which the name changes. The breathing sound at the front is dropped, and an Arabic ending is added, but the consonants remain. And this is a key thing which enables you often to trace back ancient names. So if we're looking on modern maps for what ancient Adam was, you should look for Arabic names which have the consonants, the Arabic consonants for D and M. And there is, if you look on a modern map, you can go and buy a map now, you'll find this, a place called Damia. So there's a consonant D and M with this Arabic ending ya, which is added. Sometimes spelled Damia, D-A-M-I-A, sometimes D-A-M-I-Y-A, or sometimes D-A-M-I-Y-E-H. So it's spelt as it's pronounced. And it's 17 miles north of Jericho. I put most scholars agreed ancient Adam is modern Damia. I haven't found a scholar who doesn't agree with that, right? So the vast majority of scholars agree with this. And if we just look at a map, I'll turn around just to show you. So what's remarkable about this geographical area is that this is part of the Great Rift Valley, all right? The Great Rift Valley starts up in Lebanon, I think, in the north. It comes down the River Jordan. It goes through the Sea of Galilee, through the Dead Sea. It goes down south, as it were. It goes down the Gulf of Aqaba, then into the Red Sea, and it turns around into Ethiopia. This is part of the Great Rift Valley. And there's a tectonic plate on the right-hand side of the River Jordan, a different tectonic plate on the left side of the River Jordan, and they're moving, the plate on the right-hand side is moving north, the one on the left-hand side is moving south. It's a complex structure because there's also this widening as well, and that's why in this whole region there's so many earthquakes, right? It's an earthquake-rich zone, and the geology is such that not only have you got these two main plates moving, there's actually a substructure of minor cracks and minor disturbances which actually go underneath ancient Adam, modern Damia. So that's what the geology has found out. So it's an earthquake-rich zone with these faults also going under Damia. And this is where the science comes in, so the clue of the earthquake. So go back to 1927. There's a very well-documented earthquake which shook Jericho. Buildings collapsed, you may find of interest. Walls cracked, and it was detected around the world. And this earthquake was 6.5 on the Richter scale. And just by comparison, there was an earthquake in Christchurch, New Zealand. They've had several earthquakes. The most recent one, I think, was this terrible one in 2011, which killed over 200 people, and that was 6.3 on the Richter scale. So it's a logarithmic scale, but you know it's rather similar in magnitude. So this was a major earthquake, 6.5. And it occurred, it was due to slippage on this Jericho fault. And as I said, it's part of the Great Rift Valley. And I wrote to Professor Amos Neuer, who's made a study of this, is at Stanford University, and he wrote back, and I said, can I quote your letter? He said, you can quote from my letter, and this is what he said. During the 1927 earthquakes, several ground cracks appeared together with an outpouring of groundwater. This soil liquefaction phenomenon has been well observed in earthquakes elsewhere. During the earthquake, mudslides occurred along the Jordan near Damia, about 30 kilometers, 18 miles north of Jericho. These temporarily stopped the river's flow. That was in 1927. The next slide is a photograph of a similar event in 1957, which was a lesser earthquake, and it didn't stop the Jordan flowing, but you can get a good picture of what happened. So here's this lesser earthquake, caused a mudslide. The Jordan was easily able to go around it because it was a lesser earthquake then. But you can see a more major earthquake, you get a huge mudslide, and it would stop the Jordan. And it typically takes 1 to 2 days for the water then either to get over this mud or to get around the mud. And then Amos Neuer's letter to me goes on to say, Adam is now Damia, the site of the 1927 mudslides which cut off the flow of the Jordan. Such cutoffs, lasting typically 1 to 2 days, have also been recorded in 1906, 1834, 1546, 1534, 1267, and 1160. We have historical records of those earthquakes. And then they stop in 1160. But one's tempted to extend this back to the time of when, of course, we're tempted to do this, when Jericho led the Israelites across the Jordan. He says the stoppage of the Jordan is so typical of earthquakes in this region that little doubt can be left of the reality of such events in Joshua's time. So here we have a natural mechanism that science can explain, I think, almost certainly what happened. I say almost certainly because linguistically we can identify ancient Adam with modern Damia. We know at modern Damia have been earthquake-induced mudslides which have happened intervals roughly 100 years, which have stopped the Jordan flowing. And so when this is reported in the Bible at exactly this place, which is now modern Damia, I think we can say this is what almost certainly happened when the Israelites crossed the Jordan. The Old Testament regards this as a major miracle of God. So if this is all correct, this is consistent, this particular miracle is consistent with Augustine's view of miracles. It is not consistent with Dawkins' view of miracles, right? This is a natural event, it doesn't break any natural laws, and it is, I think we agree to start with, it is a major miracle. This is a biblical, the Joshua account doesn't hint at an earthquake, but this is Psalm 114. When Israel came out of Egypt, the Jordan turned back. So he's specifically talking about the Jordan. The mountains leapt like rams. When the Bible talks of mountains leaping, it is referring to earthquakes, when mountains do shift. The earth's like lambs. Tremble, O earth, at the presence of the Lord. Right, you're tempted to interpret that figuratively, but I think it's meant literally. This is an earthquake being linked with the Jordan being turned back. It's just worth noting that the Bible never calls miracles supernatural events. And in fact, the distinction between natural and supernatural was only started to be made about 300 or 400 years ago, right? The Bible does not distinguish between natural. The Bible doesn't mention supernatural, right? It doesn't distinguish. All events are due to God in the Bible. And not only the Israelite religion, all events are due to God in ancient Egyptian religion, ancient Babylonian religion. They have many gods, all right? All events are due to many gods. So this being the case, an earthquake stopped the Jordan. If an earthquake caused the Jordan to stop, the ancient Israelites would have regarded this as just as much the hand of God as if it sent an angel to do it. They wouldn't have distinguished. It was just that it was the hand of God. Where the miracle was in this remarkable timing. So it's just as Mike Paul said, some miracles are miracles of amazing timing. And as Mike Paul says, the crossing of the Red Sea is a similar miracle in a sense. The Bible's explicit here. It was a natural event. Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. All that night, the Lord drove the sea back with a strong east wind and turned it into dry land. So here we have a natural mechanism, a strong east wind, which did this. And there's an event called wind set down, which actually can explain this, again, scientifically very well. So here we have two great miracles of timing. And this is a passage from the psalm, which I very much like. Here's a psalmist writing about miracles. And it's an amazing passage, I think, because of the insight he shows. You're the God who performs miracles. So the psalmist is saying, we're going to talk about miracles. You display your power among the peoples. Your thunder was heard in the whirlwind. So the psalmist doesn't say thunder or the thunder. It's your thunder. Your lightning lit up the world. The earth trembled and quaked. So there's the earthquake. Your path led through the sea. Your way through the mighty waters. Though your footprints were not seen, you led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. So he's talking about miracles. He ends with Moses and Aaron. So he's talking about miracles specifically, or largely at the time of Moses and Aaron. And the phrase I like here, which is remarkable, I think, is, though your footprints were not seen. So what the psalmist is saying is, God performed this mighty miracle, and he didn't come down and part the waters of the Jordan and stride across, and people would say, there's God's footprints. He didn't leave a celestial visiting card saying God was here. He performed this very subtly, and it's for people to see how it happened, and God was working in with and through the nature he created and the nature he upholds to produce this wonderful miracle of timing. But it was subtle. It wasn't that obvious, and God didn't intend it to be that obvious. His footprints were not seen. So a wonderful passage, I think, from the Psalms. So let's picture the scene again. If some of you have been to Israel, I'm sure you have, and you visited the River Jordan, you probably thought, as I did, why didn't they swim across, right? Because it's really a narrow stream. And the problem is that since 1940, both Israel and Jordan have taken large quantities of water out of the Jordan for irrigation. In fact, the Dead Sea now is falling by 1 meter a year, 1 meter per year. It's a huge fall. And what the book of Joshua tells us is that the Israelites crossed in the spring. It says that the 10th day of the month of Nisan. Nisan is the first day of the Jewish religious calendar, which is in the spring, March and April. And that's when the snows melt on Mount Hermon, and so the water comes tumbling down. And this is a photograph from the 19th century of the River Jordan in flood. And you can see it's a huge barrier for them to cross, right? It bears no resemblance to the Jordan now at all. It's just a huge barrier. There's an expedition to the Jordan in the 19th century, and they describe the Jordan as half a mile wide. Probably exaggerating, but nevertheless, very wide. So that was the river they crossed, and I think we know after 3,000 years how and where the crossing occurred. The idea of miracles of timing is not new. It goes back at least to Aristotle. What Aristotle said about miracles was there is an efficient cause, which he means, you know, what actually caused it, and it's a natural agent. But God's behind it. So the final cause, Aristotle says, was the will of God. And Aristotle says, how do we know it's a miracle? And he says, by the extraordinary timing of the event. So these thoughts go back a long way. And what we will say, I guess, today is that God was working in, with, and through the nature he created and he upholds to perform this miracle of crossing the Jordan. So just to conclude, some miracles, at least, are miracles of timing, in which God works in, with, and through the nature he created, and it's subtle. His footprints are not seen. They're seen to the eye of the believers, but they're not necessarily seen to other people. And we tentatively can say, how is the timing achieved? And we don't know this, but I just have a suspicion that God was working with Joshua and whispering in his ear, as it were, slow down a bit, Joshua, or speed up a bit, just to get this timing right. And maybe the Israelites needed to wander about 40 years in the wilderness. Maybe this was a factor to get some of the timings right. We just don't know. But the key thing, I think, the key take-home message is that a lot of miracles of timing are God and people working together to make these miracles of timing happen. And I believe that happens today as well as happening in the past for miracles of timing. So let's move on to the resurrection. As Mike Puller said, it's the most incredible event in the whole of history. And I guess many of us are almost so familiar with the resurrection that we forget just how an incredible event it really was, that a man can actually rise from the dead and have a very different body after he's risen from the body for a recognizable body, but one which can go through locked doors, so very different. Or else it's a cruel hoax. And we haven't time to talk about the evidence for the resurrection, but this is one nice piece of evidence, I think, and this is Paul writing to Corinthians. that Jesus appeared to over 500 of his brothers at the same time, most of whom are still living. Now, we know that Paul was writing in about AD 55. The crucifixion was probably in AD 33. So this was 20 years after the event, really, you know, not that far from the event. And so Paul will be right to say most of the people alive at the resurrection are still living. Most of these 500, maybe 300 were still living. What Paul is actually saying is, or is implying is, these are still living. They are in and around Jerusalem. You can go and speak to them. You can interrogate them. You can ask them about the resurrection. And Paul's just laying this down and saying, you can go and do this. And he had obviously done it himself. And you'll find out that they're all attest that they saw the risen Jesus. So, you know, really strong evidence for the resurrection, which could have been refuted, which wasn't refuted, because these people all believed in it, that they witnessed it. So, let's try and get the right slide. So we have this question, can science explain the resurrection, as Augustine would say? And certainly not with our present knowledge. And I actually think science will never do this. Now, we've got to be very careful in saying this because science is extremely powerful and has discovered things now which would have been impossible years ago. But it seems to me that science will never explain the risen Jesus appearing to his disciples through in a room where the doors were locked. If you believe this, I think, you know, we believe in quantum mechanical tunneling of tiny particles, but to believe this for a human, I think science will never explain that. And this is debatable, but I think it won't. So to me, it looks like natural laws are being broken, and a whole lot of them at the resurrection. So if this is true, then Augustine is wrong in this case, that all miracles were not contrary to nature. So the problems of miracles like this are not just problems for scientists, they're problems for theologians as well. And that's no doubt why David Jenkins was wrestling with this, as has been said. And this is the key thing. If God created the universe and is consistent, would he break his own natural laws? Augustine said no. So I want to give you an analogy, which I found very helpful. And I call this a music analogy. And let's imagine that there's a piano in this room, and someone's playing the piano, and you go across and you stand behind them, and they've got no music, and they're just playing from memory, and you observe their fingers, and you notice that every time the pianist goes to play the key F, he plays F sharp, and he does this repeatedly. And so if you're a musician, and I've got it right, then you can say, this pianist is playing this tune in the key of G major. And the key of G major is when the composer writes at the start of every line of music, he puts a little F sharp in where the F line is, and that it's his instructions of the composer to say, when you go to play an F, you actually play F sharp. This is my instructions. And scientists are like this, as Mike Paul says. Scientists are trying to reconstruct the key signature of the universe and find out the regularities whereby God has operated and these sort of scientific laws. But then you continue to watch the pianist, and you may find that sometimes he doesn't play an F sharp, he plays an F. Or he plays a C sharp or an A flat. And if you're a musician, you think, I know what's happened. The composer's put an accidental into the music score. And that's why he's doing this. And the composer, because he's the composer, he can do it. He's got every right to do it. But if he's a great composer, he's still under some restraints, I think. And the restraints are, it has to make better music, or else a great composer won't do it. So it has to be consistent with the whole piece and make better music. And I've tried this. You can go home and take a piece of music which has got accidentals in, a great piece of music, and play it without the accidentals. And you'll find it sounds so much better with the accidentals. It's the accidentals which make that piece of music great. And so the analogy is obvious, isn't it? That God is the great composer of the universe. And whereas Augustus said he is restricted to follow his own laws, this analogy says, no, he's not restricted to follow his own laws. He can put in accidentals if he chooses to because he is God. But if he's God and consistent God, he'll only do it if it makes more sense and not less sense. And if you go back to the day of Pentecost where Peter's describing the resurrection, this is what he says. He says, but God raised Jesus from the dead because it was impossible for death to keep its hold on him. So Peter's arguing, if Jesus really was the Son of God, then the resurrection was inevitable and not incredible. So the resurrection is consistent, Peter's saying, with a consistent God and with Jesus being the Son of God. So let's look a bit more. Paul deals with the resurrection in the 15th chapter of Corinthians, 1 Corinthians a lot. And just look at this very briefly. So he starts by saying, Christ being raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have fallen asleep. So what he means by this is that when Christ was raised from the dead, then when we're raised from the dead, when we die, our resurrection bodies will be similar to his. That's what he's hinting at in this verse. And then he asks this very good question. He says, someone may say, how are the dead raised? What kind of body will they come in? A really good question. And he says, body that is sown is perishable, it is raised imperishable. It is sown a natural body, it is raised a spiritual body. So he's saying it's a different body. The perishable must clothe itself with the imperishable. But Jesus was still recognizable. So this is what Paul is hinting at, that when we die and are resurrected, we will be recognizable, but it's a different body. It's a spiritual body, Paul calls it. And so what we're saying is that the resurrection of Jesus was a bit like an accidental, but I think it's much more than that. I think so many scientific laws are broken, and if a composer is putting in a whole bunch of accidentals, he changes key signature. Just for one or two bars, there'll be a change of key signature. And so I think on this analogy, the resurrection of Jesus was like a change of key signature. It was a temporary, just in time, for a short space of time when Jesus was resurrected. It was local at that place and for the body of Jesus. But we're seeing a different set of physical laws operating when Jesus was raised from the dead. And a different set of physical laws will operate in our bodies, which will be subject to no more death and no more pain and no more decay and no more suffering. So our old body, we know we're carbon-based, we're DNA-based, we're subject to disease and death. New body, carbon-based, we don't know, but probably not. DNA-based, we don't know, but probably not. Person still recognizable, no more disease and death. And it occurred to me recently that maybe we can claim the multiverse, or partially claim the multiverse view of scientists. The Bible talks about a new heaven and a new earth, so maybe this is, in modern science language, saying a new universe where the laws of science are different. And the laws of science for the resurrected body of Jesus, he could go through locked doors, and for us will be different. So a different key signature. So this is the final slide. I'm suggesting that there are at least three types of miracles. The first one is miracles of timing, where no scientific laws are broken, and really pose no problems for scientists or for theologians. Then type two miracles, some miracles like an accidental and music score, and some of the miracles of Jesus, and Mike Paul has mentioned this. If we look at Peter and Jesus walking on water, which Mike has mentioned, I like to think that no physical laws were broken. So I like to think that law of gravity still operated, surface tension still operated, but God provided an additional force. They were being pulled down, but God provided additional force, an uplifting force. And so this was an accidental, if you like, in that situation. And then I think I'd like to have type three for only one miracle, that's a resurrection, where so many laws are being broken that it amounts to a change of key signature, where we're giving a glimpse of new and different physical laws which operated with the risen Jesus, and will operate with us after death, with our new bodies after death. So I think that's the final slide. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Colin. And I'm sure there are more questions to be asked. We've got about 10 minutes left. Yes, let's start over here. Chap in the white jumper. I'm going to take questions from people who haven't asked one yet, just to save time.
My name's Mike Forward. I'm a theology student from London. And I'm interested in your type three, where you call it a temporary local change in key signature. I've been reading something called apocalyptic theology, which is the idea that the resurrection of Christ actually ushers in a whole new creation. At the moment, it's only spiritual, but it's real, and one day it will become physical and material, as you've suggested. So theologians would say that the resurrection of Christ actually inaugurates the new creation. So in that sense, it's not temporary, local, it's permanent.
That's a very good comment, though, a very good comment. Perhaps I can just comment further, so because it fits in what you're saying. So when Paul says Jesus was the first fruits of those who rise from the dead, his New Testament, the audience would know very well what he was meaning, and he was relating back to this first fruits festival in the book of Leviticus of the waving of the sheaf. And it's a first fruits festival of barley, which actually, don't get too technical, it occurred on Nisan 16, which is actually the date of the resurrection. So the crucifix on Nisan 14 in the Jewish calendar, the resurrection on Nisan 16. And what happened then was that the priests would go out into the fields of barley, they'd cut down a sheaf of barley, bring it back to the temple, wave it in the temple, and until they did that, the barley couldn't be harvested. And so when Paul says Jesus' resurrection was the first fruits of those who rise from the dead, he's saying that just as the waving of the sheaf in the temple, this first fruits festival inaugurated the barley harvest, so Jesus' death inaugurated that we would also rise with him. So it was like the inauguration of a new physical system, well, new system, as you say. So it fits together very well. Yes, thank you. Yeah?
Which represented the beginning of the wheat harvest, which was a much bigger harvest.
Yeah.
And on the day of Pentecost, you only had 120 believers, and that became 3,120 in a single day. So there's a further connection with the Old Testament feasts.
Right, that's a really good point. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Sorry. I'd like to take a question from a student. I'll give you a minute to think if you do have a question. But so while you do that, I'm going to ask the lady at the back if she's got.
Hi, I'm Karina Lobley. I'm a scientist in Oxfordshire. Thank you for your talk. I am really interested in the fact that you've separated the resurrection as a separate miracle, and I can see it leads onwards to our lives in heaven and that God has defeated death through the resurrection of Jesus, but that his wasn't the first coming to life, was it? There was the raising of Lazarus and the raising of the small boy. How do you separate those from the coming back to life of Jesus after being dead?
Thank you. Very good question. So I would say that Lazarus was a mortal person, right, flesh and blood. He died, and if you believe Jesus raised from the dead, I do. Jesus raised him as a mortal person, right? His body was much the same when he was raised, and he wasn't raised, and he died again, right? When Jesus died and was resurrected, his body was transformed, so it would never die again. So I think Jesus is the only person that's happened to. So the big distinction.
You'd like to ask? No pressure. Yes, Anna.
So I'm Anna Pearson. I was just going to ask you to comment. In one of your slides, you said that you'd attribute all events to God. Is that what you'd say, or that's what the biblical readers?
No, say it again. I attribute.
All events are attributed to God.
Right.
In a sense, not just the miracles, but all events.
Right.
So you had that statement.
Yes.
And then linking to the previous talk, the comment about is it possible, for example, the priests in Pharaoh's court, and at least for the start of the plagues, they managed to copy some of the miracles, if you could comment on that.
Right. No, look, it's a really good question. And I think I will leave some discussion, as Whitefall has said. It's a really good question, and I think the answer is probably quite difficult. And I'll just say what I sort of believe. I believe that God is ultimately in charge, right? I believe that God has created the universe, and I think there's a framework, right? Certain fixed points that God identity. I mean, the Bible talks about Jesus being slain before the creation of the world, right? So this was in God's salvation plan for the world, and I believe that the incarnation, death, and resurrection were fixed points in a world, a fixed framework. I think within that framework, there's a lot of flexibility. So you can have free will, you can have answer to prayer, right? And so there is this sort of flexibility. And God is ultimately in charge, but it's there's flexibility within this, if you see what I mean. Yeah, so it's quite subtle. And the whole question of how God interacts with the world is a difficult question, but a very important question. So maybe we can discuss that more afterwards. But thank you, it's a good question.
Any more questions? Yes, we can come down to the front here.
Hello, I'm Paul Sabo. I'm just a charter surveyor. I know something about buildings. I disagree with type 3 being the only one. Surely everyone in this room has got an interest in the resurrection of their own body. So that's got to be a type 3 event, has it not? And I think you and I discussed possibly in the past about the creation before the fall and post the fall, and how that the world, if we understand, and you as a scientist will understand better than I do, that it is not a perfect world. I mean, for instance, it's subject to the second law of thermodynamics. Therefore, it is ultimately doomed. And certainly, we would have to have a completely different world that's envisaged in, say, Revelation, and maybe heaven as well. Can you comment on that? You know, how we would have everlasting life. Well, that's got to be a miracle, has it not? It's certainly metaphysical anyway. Have you got any thoughts on that?
Right. Yes. So, so two things. One is not a perfect world, and the other is, you know, this is the only type 3 miracle. I think just looking at biblical miracles, right, then I might say this is the only type 3 miracle in the Bible. I mean, but then, as we said, Jesus inaugurated his resurrected body, which obeyed different physical rules from, you know, our normal bodies here. And as you say, we will have a similar resurrected body. This is the teaching which he and the Bible gives in a new heaven and a new earth. So, okay, this type 3 miracle will happen again and again. That's right, with us. And then the problems in the world. So I think if you believe that God chose to create the world by an evolutionary process, then here's where a lot of flexibility comes in, because if you have mutations, you'll have some good mutations, you'll have some bad mutations, you'll have parasites which are harmful, and that's part of the way the world is, and as Mike Paul has said, it's bound up with the flexibility and the freedom in the universe. And so that's how I'd explain these sorts of things, which have huge harmful effect, can have huge harmful effects on us now, and disease and illness, but in the new world, where there's no disease and illness, then there won't be these things.
Would science have any opinion on this new world, or are we in a different domain that it would have nothing to say useful, do you think?
I think we can speculate, yes, but I think, you know, that's all we can do really at the moment.
No.
John Loxton, a retired priest, down to a very practical question. When the waters are held back by the Sea of Reeds and the Jordan, what would the state of the ground underneath be? I mean, that you knew a large number of people, wouldn't there be some sort of mud, or would it be firm ground that they could walk over?
Right. So what's the state of the ground underneath? When I think it depends on where the crossing of the Red Sea actually occurred, which is still debated, as you all know. The ground is extremely variable in these areas. So I was astonished to find at the head of the Gulf of Aqaba just thick clay underneath the sand. So there's a few inches of sand underneath thick clay. And the geology of the region varies quite a lot from place to place. And so when we know where the Red Sea crossing was and get some agreements on that, then we'll be able to look at the geology there. But it's quite possible that they could walk along, cross on fairly firm ground, I think.
One died. So it wasn't reported.
Yeah.
So okay. Thank you very much, Colin.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you.